Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. A New Hampshire woman wins the $500 million Powerball lottery and wants to remain anonymous. The governor nominates a new state Supreme Court Chief Justice, and legislation advances to ban gay conversion therapy. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. And you can call into The Exchange, join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Also, we are streaming a live video of this radio broadcast, so it is very easy to listen and watch. Just head over to our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. And we are going to start the show by talking about the winner of the Powerball lottery. And we want to hear from you on this. Should she be allowed to remain anonymous? It's not as simple as you might think, though. We'll get into the details. And what is the importance of disclosing the name of a lottery winner anyway? Again, the number for you to call to lend your voice to this conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And Ethan DeWitt, I want to go to you first because this is your first time as a guest for the full hour of the Roundup. Welcome to the program.
Sure. Happy to be here. I'm the Statehouse reporter for the Concord Monitor, which means I cover the both legislative chambers, the governor's office, the executive council, and the New Hampshire congressional delegation as well.
Good to know. Okay. How long have you been on the job?
Since September.
Since September. Great. Yeah. Well, it's great to have you here. Always good to have a new voice on the Roundup. So let's all talk about this case of the woman known as Jane Doe in court filings who won the $560 million Powerball lottery. And Trent, we'll go to you. Union Leader's been covering this, as have many news organizations. So why is she going to court to remain anonymous?
So she's concerned about her safety. She says, if my name gets out, people will be hounding me. Her attorneys filed paperwork. They used examples from across the country of lottery winners who were stalked, whose homes were broken into, and one who was murdered. And so what she did was she won this lottery ticket. And, of course, imagine all this – and her lawyer said there are all these feelings when you win the lottery. First, you're not sure that you really won, and then you're totally happy. And then she panicked about her safety. And what happened was she went to the lottery website. And on this website, it says, if you win, immediately sign your ticket. And it actually says that on the ticket, too. Anyone can see that when they play. So she did that. What she's arguing now is that the lottery actually gave her bad advice. She realized after she signed the ticket that she actually had the option to collect it in a trust, in which case only the name of the trust would become public, and her name would never become public. This just happened 2 years ago when somebody won in Raymond. So she has now filed essentially suing the state to make sure that her name can remain private. And it's funny because her attorney asked, can I take this winning lottery ticket with my photo ID, with my signature on it, can I just white out my name and right in front of you at the Lottery Commission headquarters, can I white out my name and put the name of my trust on there? And they said, if you alter that ticket in any way, you're going to lose $500 million.
Okay. So is she arguing then that the lottery website should have said, write your name or the name of a trust. Is that their argument?
Their argument is that the lottery website essentially gave bad advice and that they should either be allowed to collect it in a trust or they should be allowed to white it out in the presence of lottery officials and replace her name with the name of her trust.
Dean.
Yeah, as Trent said, history is full of individuals for whom winning the lottery is a life-changing event and not necessarily in a good way. And we've seen in recent years literally a cottage industry in the legal profession develop of lawyers who specialize in how to deal with winning large lottery tickets, big winnings like this, because it can lead to a lot of problems. And you're seeing increasingly when people win these big jackpots, it can often take up to a month for them to come forward if they're required, or increasingly choosing to remain anonymous because it has been such a concern about safety, about constant harassment, people asking for money, et cetera. We may see some sort of change over time and kind of explanation of the rules and, as Trent said, kind of the advice that you get. But increasingly, people are meeting with lawyers first, setting up trusts, staying anonymous if possible.
You know, it was interesting. When we put this story on the front page of the Sunday News, this story instantly became an international story. People picked this story up all across the world, and people were linking to our story from national news outlets everywhere. I mean, this was a huge story. And I made sure to put in the story that we didn't actually know the name of the winner. And what was interesting was that people either misread that or didn't care, didn't get that far down in the story. And so we actually started receiving emails from people. I got an email from a woman in California who said, hey, I read your story. You know, I know this woman is concerned about her safety, but I have cancer and I will take just 1% of her winnings and that will help me with some of my treatment.
Just tiny 1%.
Just a tiny 1%.
$560 million. Yeah. Well, so what is the importance really of disclosing either the name of the person or the name of a trust when there is a winner of a lottery? What's the importance of that?
The importance is the state's right to know law. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. This is a check. Making sure that the person's name becomes public is a check on the lottery. It makes sure it allows people to understand who is cashing out winnings. It helps us understand and make sure that there isn't any corruption, that government officials aren't cashing out winnings, that their family members aren't cashing out winnings. I mean, it's an important piece of transparency.
Well, the transparency also allows for a trust, which could mask a government official or something else. So, I mean, what's the practical difference?
And that's a great point. And that's something that after this story ran, I think a lot of people are really looking at whether or not trust should just be allowed at all times, or you know what the law should really be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because someone said that you know it's sufficient to know that at least there was a winner, as opposed to not having a winner at all and having the state, for example, say, yeah, there was a winner, but you don't get to know either the name of the person who won or the name of the trust. At least we have the name of the trust.
At least we have something. And with the name of the trust, there has to be a trustee. And so you would know, you know, in the case of the Raymond Powerball winner, attorney Bill Shaheen came forward and collected it on behalf of the trust. So you at least know that somebody is getting that money.
Okay. Well, that's a story that is not going away, right? Because there's still the pending court case. And she apparently wants a quick decision on this because, oh my God, so much interest per day she's losing because
almost
she's not collecting this yet.
$15,000 of interest per day. The court scheduled a hearing in about a month, and she said, I'll lose $250,000 just in interest alone if I can't collect sooner.
Yikes. Wow. Okay. Well, there's been some other headlines this week that we should get to. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Big headline this week on the ban for what's called gay conversion therapy. The New Hampshire House voted on this. We'll go to you, Dean, on this. What exactly would this bill do?
The bill is literally, as you said, a ban on conversion therapy. Conversion therapy is a type of therapy in which an individual can go through therapy in order to have their sexual orientation change. The idea is that if you're gay and you go through this conversion therapy, you can then become heterosexual. And it's a very controversial therapy. People who have been through it said it's brutal. There's a lot of discussion, sort of scientific discussion about how it's not based in a factual idea of sexual identity being determined at birth. So a number of other states have moved to ban this, and this is one that now has been discussed in New Hampshire pretty intensively in this session.
Yeah, and Ethan, you've been covering the legislature. How did this vote go?
Sure. I mean, this was about as dramatic as it gets. It was a split vote, 165 to 165, in the last session last month on this. And that very rarely happens in a 400-member House. And the Speaker of the House actually came in and cast the deciding vote, tie-breaking vote, against this bill. And what emerged after that was that one representative had pushed the wrong button. Our legislature uses green and red buttons on every seat to decide votes. And he said that he had pushed the wrong button and had accidentally voted against the bill. So he put in a motion for reconsideration, which got taken up. And when that passed yesterday, the House overturned its previous vote and voted in favor of the conversion therapy ban, 179 to 171. So it was quite a dramatic turn of events.
Yeah, you were referring to Democratic Representative Henry Parkhurst.
Yes.
Who explained what happened to NHPR's Jason Moon.
I don't want children being told that what they're doing is wrong and they need to be repaired. As I thought it through, I realized that I had misunderstood what the vote really was. I'm just aghast that I did such a stupid thing.
Well, it seems like the fight is not over for this. What's next for this legislation, Ethan?
Well, it will pass on to the Senate, and I'm not exactly sure what the feeling is there, but the governor has given an indication that he will support it, that he opposes the practice. He hasn't given a clear indication yet, but he's sort of implied it.
Could I ask either the other guys on the panel a question? I read that quote, that sound bite that we just heard. I don't really understand what he means. What was the nature of the confusion? He didn't understand it was a ban. He rethought the idea of what conversion therapy is. Like, I don't understand he's not clear about sort of what the mix-up was.
Sure. I mean, in a lot of ways, it seemed like he was earlier sort of couching a little bit. He wasn't directly saying that he would sign the bill. We asked him about it on Wednesday, and he said that his previous statement speaks for itself. And again,
are you talking about Sununu?
Sununu.
I was talking about the legislator who the clip we heard about who thought he made a mistake.
You're referring to Henry Parkhurst.
Yes.
So why exactly was he confused?
Yeah, I didn't understand what the confusion was after now having heard and read that twice.
Sure. Well, I can't speak to that representative specifically, but there was some opposition centered around the language in the bill. A lot of Republicans were saying that it goes too far and that it would impede the ability for family doctors and therapists to talk about gender issues at large for children. The bill does say that it covers not just sexual orientation, but gender identity, and that includes, according to the bill, efforts to change behaviors or gender expressions. And so some Republicans were arguing that that would be too broad and would curtail the practice. So that was some of the opposition there.
Meanwhile, part of this discussion has to do with the wife of Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue, Kathy, who had emailed all the members of the House, asking them to kill this ban, essentially. And the bill's prime sponsor, Democratic State Representative Ed Butler, reacted this way to Kathy Edelblue's email.
I wondered how it was that the education commissioner's wife could be as poorly educated on this issue as the email indicates.
So claiming that she is poorly educated, sure, that's a discussion for another day, perhaps. But one thing we should mention is, why is she doing this at all, and how did she get that email address, Trent?
Well, it's a public email address. Anyone can
email all the
House
representatives.
You can email all the House representatives. You can email all the state senators. I mean, and there was some controversy about this rep's remarks in that, you know, once that because she is the education commissioner's wife, that she has no right to speech anymore. I think there's no love lost between Frank Edelblue and Democrats in the House and the Senate. I think there's just philosophical disagreement about what public education should look like in the state of New Hampshire. And it seems like any time the two of them interact, there's a lot of friction.
Mm-hmm. So how much sway would we say that she actually has in this debate?
I would assume as much sway as anyone else who emails the entire House. I mean, we get forwarded emails that go to the entire House all the time, and they are like, picture the worst office email reply all chain that you've ever been part of. Now multiply that by 400 reps. That's what this is.
Dean, agree?
Yeah, it's interesting to me because, you know, the people who support conversion therapy typically come from the social and religious conservative community. It's something that has been largely discredited in kind of mainstream medical research and psychology research. And so that comment we heard was kind of taking a shot at Frank Edelblue's wife. But that kind of fits in with the debate over this around the country. It's very controversial. And as I said, other states are moving to do away with it.
Ethan DeWitt.
Yeah, just one last thing on this. One thing that's interesting about the debate in New Hampshire is at least the people who have been vocal about it on the Republican side have not actually claimed that they support conversion therapy or anything like it. They say that they are just as opposed as Democrats. They say that this bill is an overreach to fix the problem and that there should be a more pared-back version. And, of course, Democrats have pushed back in saying that that version would not effectively do the job.
Do we know if gay conversion therapy is being practiced in New Hampshire?
That's another thing that's come up in committee hearings as this bill has progressed. There haven't been at least public complaints, and the argument is that there are probably many instances that in which it's not known, but that it's kind of unquantifiable at this point. And that's one point the Republicans have been making. They've been saying, why don't we slow down? We don't have any clear public examples of this. We can slow down and get this right so that it doesn't impact practices.
Worth mentioning that Jennifer Horne, former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party, did support this ban. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and coming up on the show, we're going to be talking about seatbelts. New legislation would make New Hampshire drivers wear them while they're on the road. Is this totally antithetical to the New Hampshire way, or is this common sense legislation? Weigh in. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, the number 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. We'd love to hear from you that way. exchange@nhpr.org. While we're on the topic of Frank Edelblue, the executive council voted for a raise for the education commissioner, but that went along party lines. Andrew Valinsky, for example, declined because he says Edelblue is unqualified for the job. So, Dean, on this decision by the executive council, is this sort of partisan grandstanding on the part of the Democrats, or is there something more to this?
Well, it's certainly part of the ongoing kind of political battle over Frank Edelblue's appointment. If you remember back at his initial confirmation hearing, Andrew Valinsky, Democratic member of the executive council, went after him quite aggressively. You know, my understanding is typically these kinds of pay raises, and this was a 6.5% raise from 93.8 up to 99.9, are not controversial. But Edelblue has been a controversial commissioner. Some have argued that he's been too overtly political, that part of the mission of the department is to protect public education, and his true interest lies elsewhere in vouchers and homeschooling. So he's received a lot of criticism. So it's not surprising for me to see the two Democrats, Valinsky and Pappas, vote against this. It is noted that the previous commissioner made $122,000 in 2016. So $99.9 is not out of line with salary. It's more just sort of an ongoing political battle over Edelblue, his appointment, his intentions as commissioner, et cetera.
Okay.
And there is a statute also worth noting, RSA 94.3, that it's a little bit unclear how it's interpreted, and I can't say that I know the exact answer, but it says that the holders of these positions are entitled to an annual increase of salary, which would be this salary, but it also says upon recommendation of the appointing authority. So there was some little bit of political debate over how much this was grandstanding over something that was already pretty much guaranteed and how much this was a legitimate use of the executive council to check on a commissioner.
I just wonder if he is the lowest paid state education commissioner in the country.
Good question.
Could you imagine that, making less than $100,000 and essentially being in charge of the state's entire education policy?
Sure. That's your assignment, Trent. You're on
there, it. That's a good story.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're speaking with Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about a bill that would mandate that Granite State drivers wear seatbelts. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a live video stream of this broadcast. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. Call us now to weigh in on the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about this diversity council that the governor has assembled. The Governor's Council on Diversity held its first meeting this week. We'll go to you, Ethan. What is the purpose of this council?
Sure. So the council, has been presented and was presented yesterday at the meeting, is kind of an attempt to bring a bunch of stakeholders to one table to conduct listening sessions and kind of explore ways to improve diversity around the state in kind of a start from scratch kind of way. If you went to the meeting yesterday, you would come away with a very broad objectives to, again, kind of listen and to hear without coming in with any prescriptive solutions from the beginning.
I thought that's what they were supposed to do, come up with some solutions, some recommendations to the governor.
Sure. But they are hoping to do that through an informative approach that is sort of dictated by the people who show up to the meetings. There was a lot of talk about, we do not want to determine what this council will do right now. We want the people who are struggling with issues relating to diversity to do that, and we'd like to listen. I did speak to Devin Chafee, who's executive director of the ACLU, and she said a few things that they want to look at specifically, immigration-related issues, police practices and implicit bias, issues affecting people with mental illness, and kind of the educational system generally. But it's sort of, at this point, kind of up to the future meetings.
And Dean, what do you think is the significance of a Republican governor having founded such a council?
Well, you know, we're in a period in which we've seen an uptick in the reporting of hate crimes and racial incidents. And, you know, I think that the governor thought this would be an opportunity to have a conversation about issues of race and try to make the state more diverse and inclusive. You know, New Hampshire is known for being a predominantly white state. I think it's 94% of the population, something like that. And so, you know, this is an issue that resonates with younger voters and millennials. And the governor himself is a young governor. And so this is the kind of discussion I think increasingly that people want to have. And so he's tapping into that, basically.
Ethan.
And one of the things that Rogers Johnson, who is chairing the council and is the president of the Seacoast NAACP, he gave opening remarks yesterday, and he was stressing that, yes, the demographics are overwhelmingly white in this state, and that might cause people to think that there aren't racial issues or aren't as many diversity issues, but they're there, they're often hidden, and they should be brought to the surface through the council. And the governor also gave opening remarks to that same end.
Mm-hmm. So when might those recommendations be due to the governor?
I'm not actually sure on that. I think they have to issue reports sometime later this year. But they're planning monthly meetings right now, and they're hoping to do it in different geographic areas as they go along.
Okay. Also in the headlines this week, this legislation that would mandate the use of seatbelts for adults on New Hampshire's roads. Trent, there was some testimony on this bill earlier this week. What kind of arguments did we hear both in favor and opposed to this?
New Hampshire is the last state in the country not to mandate seatbelt use for people over the age of 18. Since the 1980s, states have been creating these laws, and New Hampshire, the live free or die state, has withheld any kind of legislation. It actually hasn't even come up this decade. It failed back in 2009, and no one has even tried since then. So the argument is, this is the live free or die state, and you should have the ability to make a decision, adults, to make a decision on your own about whether or not you should be, whether or not you want to wear a seatbelt. And if people want to make bad decisions, state reps have argued that they should be allowed to do that. You know, on the other hand, there was the monitor covered a nurse who said, you don't understand what it's like to sit at the bedside of a 12-year-old child who you have to tell that their parent died because they weren't wearing a seatbelt. So it's a pretty passionate argument on both sides. And I think we'll see. I mean, this is a This is kind of like the quintessential New Hampshire vote. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Ethan.
And it's coming at a time when national traffic fatalities and accidents are on the uptick the last 2 years. And in New Hampshire, in 2016, they were high, unusually high. In 2017, as I understand it, the accident rate was high. The fatality rate dropped. And there's a lot of theories as to why. But there's certainly been an uptick generally. And that's sort of the backdrop here.
Dean.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think New York was the first state to enact this in 1984, and I was still a New York resident at the time, and I remember it was really odd to have these signs pop up on the various parkways saying that you had to buckle up, and ever since then, every state except for New Hampshire has done it. Seatbelt usage nationally, I think, is at about 90%. Here in New Hampshire, it's more like 70%. This is one of those issues where it's sort of, they're clear, kind of, medical community has clear opinions about this. As Trent said, I've talked to ER doctors about this as well, and they also throw in motorcycle helmets into the seatbelt discussion. Obviously, if you're an adult, you don't have to wear one in New Hampshire. So there's kind of a medical cost issue and the impact to society in New Hampshire versus kind of the cultural ethos of the state as a live free or die state, and that has thus far included seatbelts and motorcycle helmets.
Okay, so what is the outlook for this bill when all is said and done? Does anybody know? Ethan?
I have not been following this bill closely.
With a vote like this, it's really anybody's call in the House. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are Republicans who say this is nanny state. And then, there are some who may not think this is such a bad compromise for reasonable safety rules on the highway. Anyway, we'll have to follow this. This is fascinating. At least it is to me. So we'll stay on top of the story. But there's another one that we should talk about this week, which is the Family Medical Leave Act. New Hampshire House voted yesterday morning to move forward on bringing a family and medical leave program to the state, even after the Commerce Committee recommended against it. Trent, what would this bill do?
So here's the deal. This bill would mandate that when you start a new job, just a little bit under 1% of your weekly paycheck would be pooled, would go into what legislators are calling an insurance program that would pay you for 6 weeks if you had to take leave from work for the death of a spouse or your grandmother getting sick or you breaking a leg or, it would provide 6 weeks of pay up to 60% of your regular wages in exchange for paying in every week. And so there's a lot of debate about this. Some people see this as a new tax. Some people think that the setup is not fair in that you can opt into the program and potentially not pay that much and then collect, and so other taxpayers are on the hook for you, but other people say there's no net in New Hampshire, and that there are many places where you don't get sick time, and so this is the sponsors are trying to create kind of a safety net for people who don't get sick time, giving them the option to pay into this pool. And collect up to 60% of their wages if something bad happens to them.
Mm-hmm. And Bedford Representative Lori Sanborn warned that because the program is voluntary, it would be, in her view, a gamble.
If we don't have enough participation, the math doesn't work. The money won't be there. And guess what? That means all of you will have to pay for this.
So all of us may have to pay for that. Is there a political will to sort of take that risk, Dean, you think?
That's been the debate all along, that the concern among conservatives is that if the program doesn't meet its threshold in terms of funding, that the state is going to have to come up with the money down the road, because once you provide this kind of benefit, even if it's voluntary, it's very hard to say, sorry, you're out of luck, it ran out of money. This is one of those issues, along with, I think, full-day kindergarten, that actually there was support among both Republicans and Democrats. Again, this is another one of those generational issues that seems to resonate, in particular with younger voters. It ran into trouble in the Commerce Committee in January. Now it's got to go back to the Finance Committee for more debate, and then on to the Senate. I think it has a chance of passing, but you never know with these things; they can get derailed.
It's proven very resilient so far. The overturning an ITL from a Commerce Committee is not always easy.
ITL, inexpedient to legislate.
Exactly right.
Okay.
And it seems to, every time it comes before the floor, command a decent margin of support. Although this margin should be noted, yesterday the votes were in opposition were a bit more by about 15 or so.
It to Ethan's point, it has been very resilient in the House, almost shockingly so. I mean, it's very rare to see a bill survive this many rounds, and the House, the entire House, keep coming back to say, we want this, we want it again, we still want it. And the real question is going to be what happens in the Senate. Yep. This actually started with a senator from right here in Concord, Senator Feltes, and who's a Democrat. And, you know, the Republican, there are more Republicans in the Senate than Democrats, and so that's going to be the key test for this bill.
Sure. Can I should note that the prime sponsor, Mary Guile, told me yesterday she is under the understanding from Senator Feltes that it actually has more support in the Senate. So if they can just push it through, of course, that means getting through finance, which is sort of notoriously hard on these things. Republicans are pointing to the $14 million startup cost, and that's probably going to come up a lot in finance. One thing to note also about the bill that passed yesterday is to accommodate these concerns about long-term viability and the idea that if not enough people sign up, there'll be too many costs. They cut the eligible time you can take off from 12 weeks to 6 weeks, and then they increased the amount that employees would pay into it. And so Democrats and other supporters are saying this addresses those costs, and some Republicans say that it doesn't.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been speaking with our guests today about the week's news. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the Safe Stations program in Manchester and its use of Lyft to transport people in need of substance abuse treatment to the professionals who can help them. What do you think of this? The number to call is 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post to our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a live video of this radio broadcast. So let's talk about opioids for a bit, because Senators Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan say they were able to get some money to fight the opioid crisis. How much were they able to secure? Do we know?
It's about $6 billion over 2 years.
Not just for New Hampshire, though.
Not just for New Hampshire. And that's the question, is how much will New Hampshire get? And I was on a call with them yesterday, and they weren't sure yet. So there was essentially an agreement that, hey, look, here's what the big picture is going to look like with the budget. It will include $6 billion for opioid treatment over the next 2 years. That's up from about $1 billion. But the issue is, how does that $6 billion, which is appropriated by the federal government, how does it get to the states? And what is happening now is it is kind of doled out per capita. So states like California and New York get a lot more of that money.
Per capita based on population, not on number of overdoses or problems per resident.
And okay. So our senators are fighting for that to be changed to reflect the mortality rate. And so states like New Hampshire and West Virginia, where this crisis is really hitting hard, would receive more federal funding.
Yeah, the top three states West Virginia is the highest number of overdose deaths. New Hampshire, I believe, is tied with Ohio for second. So two of those three states are small states, and that is the issue. I think they had originally wanted to bump the funding from $1 billion to $25 billion, but they're settling for six, which is still a big improvement. But it's all tied up in this formula. If it's just done based on population, places like California and New York and other big states are going to get most of the money. And so that's what their fight really is over how this gets distributed.
And I think it should still be noted that that the agreement that passed this morning, and as I understand, was just signed into law by President Trump this morning, is to raise the debt ceiling and to extend a spending agreement for six more weeks and to add more money for military. The agreement that was passed by both houses and is now signed by the president does not specifically say anything about the opioid money. That was formed the bill doesn't say anything. The agreement was formed between leadership. So what remains to be seen is how that kind of plays out over the next few weeks and how that funding formula is decided. The Trump administration could jump in through its Department of Health and Human Services and unilaterally change the formula itself. This formula was set in the last month of the Obama administration, or the Congress could pass a law that forces the HHS to implement this funding formula that's better for New Hampshire. So it's just up in the air over how that moves forward.
All right, we'll have to see how that comes down. Meanwhile, of course, the severity of the opioid crisis in New Hampshire has prompted officials, people in power, to be a little creative about how to solve the problem. One of those solutions has been the Safe Stations program in Manchester, which allows people suffering from addiction to sort of walk into the station, not get arrested, but get connected with treatment services, things that might be able to help them. And now those safe stations programs, the one in Manchester, is using the ride-hailing service Lyft. Trent, what need is the Lyft service now satisfying?
Transportation. And so the major – there were a number of major changes in the Manchester safe station program over the last few weeks, and I think it actually kind of went under the radar for a little while there. But what happened was the main intake center, Serenity Place, that safe stations had partnered with, the Manchester Fire Department had partnered with, went out of business. They ran out of money, and they just could not survive. And so what has happened is all those services that Serenity Place would provide have now been spread out to other providers throughout the city. So the Elliott has taken some services and a couple of other nonprofits. But a major issue was if somebody walks into the fire station and they're overdosing or they're having an issue, how do you get them from the Manchester Fire Department to one of these other places? Serenity Place was right around the corner, so it was easy. But it doesn't make sense to transport them by ambulance. You can't exactly throw somebody on the back of a fire truck and drive them somewhere. So how do you get them? The Manchester Fire Chief, who is always looking for innovative ways to handle problems, pulled up the Lyft app, put in his own personal credit card, and said, let's just try this. And it worked. So the city has now paid, I think it's about $10,000, set aside that money to help people get from like Central Fire Station to wherever they need to go in the city.
So before they started using Lyft and when Serenity Place was still in operation, were people from Serenity Place just driving these people in their own personal cars, or were they using ambulances, or was there a combination?
There was a combination, and you could you could walk there. I mean, it's like right around the corner from Central Station.
Wow. Wow. Well, this is quite an innovation. NHPR's Paige Sutherland did a story on this. You can check it out, nhpr.org. One more thing to talk about for the break, and that is that this week Governor Sununu nominated Justice Robert Lynn as the next Chief Justice of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. Trent, you're familiar with Robert Lynn. Tell us a little bit about him. How long has he been on the court?
He is the quintessential law and order justice. He used to run a DEA task force in Boston. He was a federal prosecutor. I had the pleasure of covering a trial for I spent 2 months in the back of his courtroom as he was the chief judge of the New Hampshire Superior Court. So the trial court, he oversaw the state's first capital murder case in, I think it was 60 years, the John Brooks case. He has spent a few years on the Supreme Court now. The governor has said he would like to elevate him to be the chief justice, which will be interesting. I think that, you know, I think that he has disagreed with other members of the court in the past. There was a pretty controversial ruling out of Farmington where a high school counselor there was a pregnant teenager at the high school, and the counselor said she doesn't want to tell her parents. She's afraid of them finding out. This case got all the way to the Supreme Court, and four of the justices said that the guidance counselor did the right thing by helping that student essentially avoid telling her parents about this by hiring a lawyer, hiring the ACLU. And Justice Lynn dissented, which is pretty rare on the New Hampshire Supreme Court. He said that the other justices were on the bandwagon of political correctness. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out.
So how likely is it that he'll be confirmed at the next Executive Council meeting?
Well, with three Republicans on the council, I would imagine that he's going to get confirmed.
What's interesting is with a mandatory 70-year-old retirement age, he's 68, I believe, we're going to have to go through this again in 2 years to find a new Chief Justice.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. After the break, we're going to be talking about Olympic hopefuls for New Hampshire. Looking forward to the games? Well, give us a call. We'll talk about them. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And as we tend to do here on the Roundup, the last segment, talk about animal stories. Why not? We've got a bunch this week. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, and watch a live streaming video of this broadcast at NHPR Exchange on Facebook. We'll learn more about these stories in just a few. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Arielle. I'm calling from Derry.
My name is Elise. I'm from Alaska.
My name is Ina, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
From the Alaskan wilderness to the streets of New York City, NHPR Civics 101 is your guide to how American democracy works.
I had a question about term limits.
How does the Electoral College work?
Can you help me explain the National Security Council to my students?
Subscribe to the podcast and submit your questions at civics101podcast.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Give us a call to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Dartmouth College has been celebrating the number of athletes the school is competing in the games. Wow, quite an athletic school, Dean.
Yeah, these are they're going to have 15 so-called Dartmouth-affiliated athletes. These are people who are either currently enrolled or have attended Dartmouth. So 15 of them named to the 2018 Winter Olympic team in Pyeongchang. Over the years, going back all the way to the first Winter Games in 1924, they've had 147 spots in the Winter Olympics and have won 13 gold, 9 silver, and 6 bronze. So a long, storied history with Winter Olympics, skiing, Nordic skiing, those kinds of events.
And at Dartmouth, of course, isn't the other school. There's one student from Plymouth State profiled in the Concord Monitor.
Yeah, interesting enough, this is a student from Iceland, Freydis Einarsdóttir, and she will be skiing for Iceland. She's a giant slalom and slalom specialist. It's a small team. There are only 5 Icelanders going to the Olympics, and she will be the only female alpine skier competing over there from Iceland. But this is Plymouth State's first Olympic athlete.
Wow, okay. And, there may be athletes that we haven't heard about yet, other ones from New Hampshire. Remind us who they are, listeners, if you know of one. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We don't want to leave anybody out. We'll try and get a mention in within the next 20 minutes or so. So, yeah, exchange@nhpr.org is the email address. We've got a few more stories to talk about in this hour. I want to squeeze them all in. One is Northern Pass. We spent the whole hour last week on Northern Pass because it was breaking news that they would be denied a necessary permit allowing them to move forward. Now Massachusetts officials want to make a quick decision on whether or not to drop Northern Pass from a proposed offer to supply renewable energy there. Trent, what are the details with Massachusetts and that decision that they have to make there?
So Massachusetts, by the end of, they have about 6 more weeks to decide whether they're going to essentially try and go with another project. So don't forget, what happened was the Massachusetts authority said, hey, we are going to put out a proposal for somebody to bring us clean energy to the Bay State. 40 different projects applied. Northern Pass was selected, mainly because everyone thought it was going to get SEC approval and it would be construction would be happening in the next few – would start in the next few weeks. Then obviously the shocking turn of events with the SEC voting against it. So now Massachusetts has to make a decision. Are we going to stick with Northern Pass and hope that this rehearing that the Northern Pass project is going to ask for, are we going to hope that that goes through and that the site evaluation committee changes its mind? Or that a Supreme Court appeal will happen in time for this project to kind of stay on the rails? Or are we going to go back and look at the other 39 players in the game and see if we can go with one of them?
Okay. And so in the meantime, there are other projects under consideration in New Hampshire, right? The Granite State Power Link, is that an option here?
There's the Granite State Power Link, which has been pushing very hard. That uses existing right-of-ways and has so far not been quite as controversial.
And that would be an option for Massachusetts, I believe.
And that would be an option. I was also interesting to see the president of Hydro-Québec, which was going to be the partner in Canada, partnering with Eversource to build this. Hydro-Québec basically saying, we always thought that Northern Pass wasn't going to work out. So we actually had been looking at options in Vermont and Maine. They had never said that before in 7.5 years, so it was a little surprising to hear that. So it sounds like there's power in Canada, people wanting to Massachusetts, and people are looking for other ways to make that happen.
Okay, certainly a story that's not over yet. Thank you very much for the update, Trent. Another story that we should talk about, very sad news this week. Former state lawmaker Sam Cataldo died in a car crash last weekend. Dean, how are people remembering Sam Cataldo?
Yeah, well, there are lots of remembrances of him for his time in the House and Senate. He served a combined 12 years in the state House and State Senate. He was 80 years old. You know, sort of different kinds of remembrances. He was a strong Republican. Some data suggests he voted with the GOP about 96% of the time. I recall back a number of years ago him kind of being mentioned in conjunction with the Tea Party, but he did support the expanded Medicaid, which was one of those interesting issues to see how Republicans would vote. So, you know, a lot of sadness. You know, he was a former state senator, but people remembering over a decade of service to the state.
And he had sort of an outsized personality. A lot of people talked about that. And what's interesting is that the Senate right now, actually the makeup of it doesn't actually overlap a lot with his term. So if you talk to senators, many senators don't know him, but the aides in the state house do. And on Monday, the day after the announcement of his passing, there was a notable mood among aides whenever he came up. He seemed to really affect a lot of people.
His calling hours are today, Friday, from 4 to 7 at the Peasley Funeral Home in Farmington, just in case anyone is wondering.
Thank you very much for that, Trent, and so sad to see. Condolences to the Cataldo family. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests today about the week's news. And if you'd like to weigh in, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post at our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. A few more stories to talk about before the end of the hour. Among them, Christina Fay, who is still fighting to get some of her dogs back. She was convicted on 10 counts of animal cruelty after dozens of Great Danes were seized from her Wolfboro mansion. Dean, what exactly does she want now?
Yeah, well, you may recall at the end of the court case, the judge said that she would be allowed to have one. I think it was one dog. It was a very small number, I believe. It may have been one Great Dane to have personally, and would not be involved in the adoption or placement of all the other Great Danes. And she went back to court asking for 12 of the older dogs, 12 elderly Great Danes. She said they're like family to her, and she wants to spend their remaining time with them. So basically asking for custody and also continuing to want to be involved in placement. And the judge said no. And also would not allow Faye to have a say in where these Great Danes go. So she really did not make any progress in trying to get back her dog. But you know, this is a case we talked about extensively on the Roundup, a very sad case. And she was convicted of a number of felonies for not taking care of these animals properly.
Okay. And so what have judges said so far about this request? Anything?
No, they said the judges said they that she that was an individual judge. Said that she could not have the 12 back, and that she would not have a say in where they're adopted.
Okay. And meanwhile, she could be on the hook for some of the financial costs for caring for these dogs while these appeals play out, right?
I think that's the case. I'm not 100% sure what the agreement is, but there are some fines and
some restitution
involved.
About $150,000.
It was pretty significant, yeah.
$150,000. But yeah. She lives in a multimillion-dollar mansion, and there are resources there.
Okay. Another important story to mention this week has to do with the founder of emergency veterans clinic, veterinary clinics in Manchester and Concord. She went before the State Board of Veterinary Medicine, or she's going to be next week, to answer complaints about her practice, including allegedly forcing patients to surrender pets if the owner can't afford a necessary surgery. Trent, what is the deal with this story?
This is a complicated story. This involves the Advanced Veterinary Care Clinics in Manchester and Concord. There are 5 complaints that are being taken up by the State Vet Board about the owner forcing people to surrender their pets. The gist of the complaints are, and they're complicated complaints, so I'm going to simplify them here. But the gist is, you'd come in with an animal. The clinic would say, "Listen, I'm sorry, but it's going to be about $2,000 to help care for your animal. You can surrender the pet now." And what the clinic would do would be put them on GoFundMe and say, "We need to raise $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for these pets," and they would raise that money. So some owners are complaining that was unethical. The owner of this clinic says, "These are just unhappy customers. We deal with hundreds and hundreds of cases all the time. There are only 5 unhappy people, and they have a vendetta out against us."
Wow. And so what is the argument there that it's unethical? I mean, if you can't afford to get your pet a necessary surgery, should you be given it for free? Is that what they're expecting?
Yeah, they're expecting that. And the what the owner says is, you know, we've done – when we do a free service – that pet owner goes and tells 10 other pet owners that we did something for free or for low cost, and we just can't afford to stay alive. I shouldn't phrase it like that, but we can't afford for the business to stay afloat by doing free services. I mean, it costs money to provide these to care these animals.
And is there? I don't know if any of you know this, but I'm curious about it. I mean, is there a huge difference? I mean, there must be a huge difference in how you legally treat care for a pet versus medical care for a human being, which, you know, you can't go to the emergency room and be turned away legally. But a pet could.
A pet, you can ask for money up front, where you can't do that. And if you or I went to the hospital, you know, the Elliot couldn't say, well, that's going to be a $15,000 surgery. We want your credit card right now. They can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that with a pet.
So she's going to make her case next week, but she sort of said that, you know, these allegations aren't quite fair, right? Is that what she said?
She says that these allegations aren't fair and that she deals with hundreds of cases every year and that these are just unhappy people. And, you know, we'll see what happens with the veterinary board.
Yeah, I will just say from personal experience, this is a very, very difficult situation to deal with. I had a dog a number of years ago who broke his leg. He was a Frisbee dog, and he went up to catch a Frisbee, came down on his back leg, and it snapped.
Oh.
So we had to have emergency orthopedic surgery. You know, it's very emotional. It's a family member. You know, I don't recall ever even asking about the cost. He just went in, had the surgery, and it was thousands of dollars. And fortunately, we were in a position to be able to cover it. But I have talked to other people who, you know, you're put in a position as a pet owner. Can I afford this? Can I afford $2,000-$3,000, or do we put the animal down? And this is just another version of sort of how do you deal with those sort of difficult questions? Because it is different than if you're dealing with a human being in terms of going to the ER or something like that. And I've had conversations in particular with that orthopedic surgeon about some of the difficult situations he had seen when people literally had to decide, you know, do we pay $3,000 for the surgery or do we put the dog down? And it's just a very tough thing to deal with.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
I can't even imagine having to make that decision. So, all right, well, we'll have to stay on top of this story. It's incredibly fascinating. And I'm almost reluctant to talk about this next one. I mean, you know, as from a reporter's perspective, you spend all week making phone calls and talking about complicated stories and parsing the difference between this word or that word. And then you get home and your girlfriend says, did you hear about the lizard and the salad? This is what people are talking about.
This is what people are talking about. And, you know, we also try to avoid it for as long as possible. And but it just spread so like wildfire on social media. And at a certain point, we feel like we need to jump in here and ask questions and find out what the truth is.
Yep.
And hold people accountable. And so here's the story. A woman in Kittery, Maine, bought a bag of lettuce from Shaw's, and she said she was eating the lettuce and actually even provided a photograph, which is on unionleader.com if you want to look, and found a lizard tail in it. She kept digging through and saw the rest of the lizard body. This isn't crazy. I mean, this can happen.
It's serious. It is a serious story.
It's a serious story. It can happen, right? Like lizards and lettuce. It's nature, people. So anyway, Shaw says, look, we're investigating this. We don't know. And these stories are always hard for us to report because you're essentially taking somebody's word that they didn't put that lettuce in the salad, that they didn't. And if you actually look at the picture, and I don't mean to get too graphic here, but she's got dressing and everything in there. It looks like she ate half the salad already. So I don't know.
Well, there are actual legitimate concerns about, I hadn't thought of this, but E. coli and other potential salmonella, other concerns. I think that the issue is that the lettuce came from California, so this actually is passed on to the FDA. But, you know, companies are always very concerned about this kind of stuff. But it is true, as Trent said, that, you know, for every one of these that is serious, you'll often see something where it turns out to be a hoax. So it's you know, the companies want to be responsive. And I think sometimes the people who report these things are concerned that they're going to be accused of kind of creating the crisis.
And just something across the pond in the UK, I think also this week, the supermarket chain Aldi had to recall thousands of bags of frozen vegetables because half a rat was found in one of the frozen vegetable bags.
Oh, my God.
So it continues.
I'm grossed out. So did this story come out with any recommendations on proper food preparation techniques? And because I'd love a refresher course. yours at this moment.
Well, I guess if you can't see that there's a lizard in your salad.
It was green, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. People said it kind of looked like a pickle, so there's that.
That's true.
Oh, boy. That's gross. Anyway, all right. So before we sign off today, I want to check in with you guys about what you're going to be looking at in the coming week. We'll start with you, Ethan. What stories are you going to be following in the next week or so?
Well, so I've heard that one bill that came up yesterday was the House version of the Medicaid expansion. Now, the House actually shot that down. This is something that Medicaid expansion is the program that provides insurance for 50,000 people needs to be reauthorized this year. The House shut down its version. It put it into, I believe, interim study. But the narrative on this has always been originating from the Senate, and the word that I've heard is that Senator Jeb Bradley, Majority Leader, will have his version out next week, and that'll be something I'll be looking at the details of.
Okay. How about you, Trent?
Well, we have two really interesting stories coming up in the Sunday news that I want to tell you about. The first is a follow-up from Mark Hayward, who's really digging hard into the problems at Serenity Place. This is the place we were talking about earlier that helped with the Safe Stations program in Manchester. What happened? How did it go bankrupt? Who knew what? Who knew what, when, where, and why? All those questions. So we're really digging into that and there's all this money coming to New Hampshire. What happened? That's one. And then if you like animal stories, there are going to be 26 New Hampshire dogs and handlers in the Big Apple this weekend at the Westminster Kennel Club. We're going to profile a couple of them in the Sunday news. And hopefully there are no lizards involved.
No lizards at the Kennel Club. All right, Dean, how about you? What are you going to be looking at in the coming week?
I actually look forward to that. political news. I'm going to see how our congressional delegation continues to deal with all the sort of budgetary and DACA turmoil down in Washington. Also, some campaign election news for the 2018 midterm. Some fundraising numbers are in. And Maura Sullivan on the Democratic side seems to be out in the lead in terms of total fundraising. Several others have had good success. And finally, the Cook Political Report, which is kind of the big national handicapper of House races, has moved that CD1 to lean Democratic. And they made some comments to the effect of that they've been underwhelmed by the Republican field in that CD. So that's going to be a contentious race. We know that's a big swing district.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. So I want to thank everybody for being here today. Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and making his debut on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
And remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. After we spoke briefly about Sam Cataldo, who passed away last weekend, we got this note from Suzanne and Keene, who said, "I remember Sam Cataldo fondly. I was a liberal Democrat on environment and ag, and he was a conservative Republican on science and tech. The main thing I remember was that we could and did talk about issues. Wish that would happen more today." Fondly remembering Sam Cataldo. Thanks, Suzanne from Keene, for writing in to talk to us about Sam. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.